It's very nice to see you all here. When I arrived, I wasn't sure whether you should have had the political editor or BBC Northern Ireland's weather forecasters in terms of the rain, or whether it will be better for it to be teeming down, thus forcing people into the tent, or staying dry, allowing people to get across from Stately Home. But I'm very glad that so many of you have made the journey. And Jonathan, you're very welcome to this conversation. Now, the title of the conversation that we've been given with is The New Machiavellis, which was actually taken from a book that you wrote about Tony Blair. But I don't think we're going to talk exclusively about Tony Blair. I'm sure we will touch on him in the course of this conversation, but we'll take that title as, if you like, a starting point for looking at power politics and also how power politics can be applied to conflict resolution. First of all, you know, Machiavelli gets a pretty bad press. The general public, in as much as they know anything about him, would think that his name is a byword for cunning and malice. But you're a bit of a fan. Why?
Well, I said at the end of that book that I was probably 500 years too late to rehabilitate Machiavelli and 50 years too early to rehabilitate Tony Blair. Because, of course, Tony Blair's name also now doesn't seem to be as popular in the United Kingdom as it used to be. The thing I think that's interesting about Machiavelli is he's a very pragmatic commentator on politics. He isn't actually amoral or even immoral. What he tries to do is derive from the experience he had what were the rules of politics and how they worked. And what I wanted to do was look and see if those rules still applied in modern politics. And I looked at our 10 years in government, and I must say that most of them did. Things like it's better to be feared than to be loved still apply today as they did in the 15th century.
You said in that book that you were kind of looking, if you like, at the mechanics, at the how you wield power rather than why or to what end you wield power. Is it possible, though, to separate the two? You know, different politicians will behave very differently depending on whether they're dictators or operating in a parliamentary democracy or whatever.
Well, yes, but the mechanics are the mechanics. The ends to which you use them are different. And as I said in the book, actually, I ended up after 10 years in number 10 and 30 years in government less cynical about politics and less depressed by what politicians do and how democracy works than I was at the beginning. Of course, you can abuse power, but actually, on the whole, people go into politics in countries like Britain, in democracies, to try and change things for the better. And they spend a lot of time being abused while they do it. And most of the time, they do achieve something, even someone as much abused at the moment as David Cameron. He may have had a catastrophe on Brexit, but at least he achieved some things that he wanted to achieve in trying to make society better.
Now, as was referred to there in the introduction, currently you're working in the field of international conflict resolution with your agency, Intermediate. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing? Because you're juggling several balls in the air, aren't you?
Well, we're trying to work on eight different conflicts, which is slightly too much, but and you spend 80% of my time on airplanes. But if you take the example of Colombia, it is an interesting one, because I first went out there to help President Santos when he was elected to set up his office, the chief of staff, and all that kind of thing. And he started talking to me about Northern Ireland, because he'd been for 8 years in London as the representative of the coffee trade. And he'd actually been knocked over by an IRA bomb outside the In-N-Out Club on Piccadilly. He and his ambassador were knocked to the ground. And he told me to come back a couple of months later, and he revealed to me that he had a secret channel to the FARC in the same way that we'd had a secret channel to the IRA, and he wanted to start negotiations. But he didn't want to make the same mistakes the four previous attempts at talks had made, most notably in Caguan from 1999 to 2002. And so we put together a little panel of people to help him look at the lessons from those failed negotiations and to look at Northern Ireland and look at South Africa and other successes. And on the basis of that, he built a very firm foundation for his negotiation, which led to 1 year of secret negotiations and 4 years of public negotiations that concluded, as I've said, at the end of August, and were to be signed on the 26th of September and put to a referendum on the 2nd of October. And they have definitely derived lessons from here in Northern Ireland. Obviously, Northern Ireland is a very different type of conflict than the Colombian one. The settlement is actually very different, but the negotiations themselves, they learned a certain procedures, certain tools that worked for them as well as they worked here.
How conscious did you find people in Colombia were about the possible lessons from Northern Ireland? I know that some of the politicians from this part of the world headed out there, were involved in talks in Cuba and so on.
Well, if you remember that three members of the IRA were caught with the FARC while we were in government trying
that
to
help. Wasn't a peace mission, was it?
No, they were trying to help make air exploded petrol weapons, which were not terribly peaceful. A number of people have been out from here, from all political parties, to try and help the FARC think through the transition from violence to politics. And they have to make a transition very much like the Sinn Féin one. They've got to give up violence and try and pursue their end politically. They're going to have more difficulty in winning support. I think that they will find their support is much more localized and much less than Sinn Féin eventually managed to get politically. And hopefully that won't discourage them from going into politics, because another conflict I worked on after here was in Spain with ETA. What's notable there is that once ETA went into politics, into Batasuna, now called SOTU, they became the second biggest party in the Basque Country, and it seemed impossible for them to go back to violence once they had that political success. I hope politics will at least appeal to the FARC so we don't go back on this agreement, because agreements often fail after they've been signed and while they're being implemented.
So is there a sort of key problem, which is that if a group wishes, as it were, to trade in its arms, if it's got a certain level of support, it can trade in its arms and swap it for political influence. But if it doesn't have that level of support, there could be problems. So FARC appears to only have a relatively low level in support in Colombia, and one immediately thinks about the different fortunes of loyalism here in Northern Ireland as opposed to Sinn Féin, because they weren't able to trade their arms for votes.
I don't think it's really trading arms for votes. It's you remember that Sinn Féin started off with a dual strategy of the Armalite and the ballot box. And when they saw that they could succeed at the ballot box, they were prepared to give up fighting. I think some of these armed groups have no political support at all. And there is no point in talking to them. If you take Baader-Meinhof, for example, they had no political support. The Symbionese Liberation Army in the United States had no political support. There was no point in talking to them. I think the same would probably apply to the dissident Republicans. They don't enjoy the political support that Sinn Féin used to enjoy. So I don't think there's any purpose in engaging with them. Now, the loyalists don't enjoy widespread political support, and they can't get anyone elected to the Assembly even at the moment. They have a real problem with that since the death of Davy Irvine. But it is a tradition that seems to me that doesn't have a political voice, and it would be far better if it did have some sort of political voice and was noticed if we want to get loyalists out of the hole they're in at the moment. I mean, the policy we've followed for the last 10 years of a policing-led policy hasn't worked. They haven't managed to lock up the people doing the crime. So I think it's worth thinking about a different sort of policy where we combine some sort of incentive for those who want to go straight with cracking down on those who don't.
And of course, you've taken a very, for you, quite an upfront role in terms of being the face associated with the Loyalist Community Council here. The counter-argument, I suppose, is that decades on from the Loyalist ceasefires, these groups shouldn't be around, and that maybe you're sort of kowtowing to people who think they have more influence than they should have anyway, and it should be a matter for the police and the courts to deal with them.
Well, two points. One is that I'm not sure it's particularly helpful to get rid of the name of these organisations. The danger, for example, had the IRA gone out of business very early on, someone else would have taken over the name of the IRA and started using the brand for their own purposes. It is better that that's not possible to happen, and I think that's true probably of the UVF and the UDA. And I think we need to distinguish what we worry about and what we don't worry about. Say the loyalists were deprescribed, would we care if a UVF existed if it wasn't engaged in criminality and paramilitarism? I think that's the issue, and what we need to try and find a way of doing is cracking down on that criminality, but providing incentives for people to get out of it. I used to meet the UDA brigadiers when I was in government, and they were a colourful lot. And I must say, at that stage, I didn't think there was much hope of a political way forward. I do think there are people in loyalism now who are trying to find a way out, and I think we should try and help them if we can, while, as I say, providing the stick at the other end of the process.
We've gone down the Northern Ireland role. I'd like to return to your international work. I mean, you've given Colombia as obviously a very obvious example where you believe you've had success. Have there been areas that you can think of where you have, if you like, tried to export some of the lessons from Northern Ireland and they've said, thanks, we hear what you're saying, but no thanks?
Well, quite often the people you go and meet are very into their own conflicts, and they find it very hard to believe that any other conflict is relevant to them. They're so into the weeds of it. But encouraging them to lift their heads and actually see things in a different light is worth doing. In Burma, for example, I first went out. David Cameron went there about 4 years ago and talked to the Burmese leaders and said he'd share the lessons from Northern Ireland. So I went out there with Jerry Kelly, the bomber of the Old Bailey, and Geoffrey Donaldson. And it was interesting because we did come from a very different sort of background from Burma, but they were interested. We then invited the Burmese chief negotiator and his team to come to Northern Ireland, and they came. And they observed it was very different. But they did actually take a lot of lessons from the process here. They spent a week here. They went back. The chief negotiator then proposed all the various armed groups come here and the various groups came here. And culturally, it's very, very different. But that doesn't mean to say there aren't lessons that can help a process like that succeed. And in Burma, interestingly, at the end of August, they finally got into their peace process with all of the armed groups, all 17 of them, in the Panglong conference. And I think there's real hope there, too, that they can succeed. And they themselves talk about the lessons that they could learn from Northern Ireland. I'm not pretending there's a Northern Ireland model. There isn't. You can't take the de Hont method and take it to Burma and make it work. That's not going to succeed. And the conflicts have very different routes, very different outcomes, very different ways of getting to success. But there are things like constructive ambiguity, like deadlines, that work in all negotiations.
Of course, one can think of other areas. I think we were talking earlier about Sri Lanka. Now, that hasn't been an area that you've been personally involved in with your agency. But certainly, politicians from here, Martin McGuinness, went out there, propagated the whole business of conflict resolution. The government decided, no, we want to resort to violence and finish off the opposition.
Yep, no, Martin McGuinness went to Sri Lanka while we were in government and persuaded Tony Blair to meet Rajapaksa, the president at the time, at the moment that he was following a peace process. He abandoned that and was successful in finishing off the Tamil Tigers by military means. He then tried to suggest to the rest of the world he had an answer to terrorism by force. But there are good reasons to think that his model does not work anywhere else, or at least doesn't work in a Western democracy. Firstly, Prabhakaran, the leader of the Tamil Tigers, had always been thought to be a military genius. But in the words of the Norwegian negotiator, Erik Solheim, he turned out to be a military fool. He tried to fight a fixed campaign against the Sri Lankan army and was defeated. Had he fought a guerrilla campaign, he would still be out there fighting now. Secondly, the methods used by the Sri Lankan government to finish off the insurgency at Nandikar Lagoon, where they killed many, many thousands of civilians in the process, is not a method that you could use in a Western democracy. And lastly, the Rajapaksas failed to address the political issue at the root of the Tamil protest. The reason the Tamils were fighting were that they had been excluded from politics and abused for many generations. And the failure of the Rajapaksas to do that led to the collapse of their government. They were thrown out of office, and now there's a government in place, including Tamils, that is negotiating a new future for Tamils and Muslims in Sri Lanka, and that is working. We do now have peace in Sri Lanka. So I don't think the Rajapaksa model of war works.
Returning to our Machiavellian theme, would you see yourself as distinct from, you know, peacemakers who would say all we are saying is give peace a chance? Instead, you are using some of the kind of tools that might have been used either in indeed war or political action of other kinds in order to pursue an end which is peace in the end.
Yeah, I'm certainly no Jeremy Corbyn. I don't believe that sort of flattering the IRA during the middle of the Troubles in the way that he and MacDonald did actually served any useful purpose whatsoever. And I don't think it is right that you can deal with these problems without security measures as well as talking. But I think the governments discover that if they only use security measures, that is not going to work. You've got to try and combine the two if the group has political support. You have to have security pressure down, but you have to offer a political way out. If you don't offer the political way out, you'll have to fight and kill every last one of them in terms of the terrorists you're dealing with. If you only offer them the political way out and no pressure, why on earth would they take it? Because it's much easier to carry on fighting. So it's the combination of the two that, if you look around the world from El Salvador to Aceh in Indonesia to the Philippines, it's that combination of the two, military pressure down, a political way out, that seems to work.
Of course, the major threat facing the West now comes from Islamism, previously Al-Qaeda, now the Islamic State, the so-called Islamic State. You've written about talking to terrorists, back channels, reaching out to these groups. Are they beyond that kind of approach, do you think? Or one day, do you think that some approach of that nature may bear fruit?
Well, I've argued that even in the case of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, it is worth thinking about whether there is a political strategy as well as a military strategy. When I left government in 2008, I said that on the basis of my experience here in Northern Ireland, we should be talking to Hamas, to the Taliban, and even to Al-Qaeda. And of course, my former colleagues in the Foreign Office said I was an idiot, and it was okay to talk to the PLO, okay to talk to the IRA, but not to these new groups. In the 6 years since then, the Israelis have negotiated a ceasefire with Hamas, The Americans have negotiated the release of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl with the Taliban and are engaged in political talks with them. And the former head of MI5, Eliza Manningham-Buller, has said that we should be talking to Al-Qaeda. So people change their minds on these issues. It's interesting. Every time we meet a new terrorist group, we say they're completely different, and we just forget all the lessons we had about them before, and we'll just deal with them by violence. So now we've set on ISIS, we're going to deal with ISIS by degrading and destroying them. Now, firstly, to do that, you would need a proper military strategy, not just bombing. And we have been effective, the West has been effective with bombing and in using Kurdish fighters, both in Iraq and in Syria. But Kurdish fighters have their limitations. They can't take over Arab areas without provoking a reaction. Shia fighters from the south of Iraq can't take over Sunni cities in the north without provoking a reaction. So firstly, you need a serious military strategy that will involve someone's boots on the ground. And interestingly, there are increasing numbers of boots on the ground from the United States and France and elsewhere in Syria and northern Iraq. So if you have a military strategy, that applies the pressure. When they get to the stage of a mutually hurting stalemate, because I think it's unlikely that you will be able to destroy ISIS altogether as an idea, it seems to me, unpalatable as we may find it, that ISIS has some political support. It's very hard to imagine how 1,500 fighters could take over a city of Mosul, 1.5 million people, against the Iraqi army, unless it was that the population of Mosul thought they'd take a risk with ISIS rather than the sectarian Shia state of Maliki. So in the end, I suspect if we're going to solve this problem, we're going to have to find a way of engaging with those Sunnis who feel alienated from the Iraqi state if we're going to find any chance of settling the ISIS problem in the end, and we won't do it by just military means.
Of course, back here in Northern Ireland in Stormont, we have series of groups from different places around the world who come over to look at the experience here. But we have had some differences, if you like, about how we can exploit our experience. So, for instance, we've run into deadlock over whether there should have been a peace and conflict resolution centre at the Maze because unionists felt that that was too skewed in one way. There's a lot of talk about a museum of the Troubles, but all these decades on, it still hasn't got off the ground. Do you think that that is a failing on the part of Northern Ireland, or can you understand the reluctance to go down that road?
No, I think it reflects continuing political disagreements in Northern Ireland. But I would say there is an awful lot of interest around the world in what you achieved here in Northern Ireland. And I think that's a positive thing that the people of Northern Ireland and the politicians could make more of if they chose to do so. You know, there is a demand to know how it worked from most surprising types of places. And I think the success here is something you should be prouder of and should do more to talk about around the world. It shouldn't be people like me doing it. It should be people who are actually on the ground, the ones who made the real sacrifices, who should be doing it.
Now, I'm intending to move on to other spheres, and there are many of them, of Jonathan's life. But if anybody had any particular points that they wanted to raise about conflict resolution, now might be the time to do it. I've got one here in the front row, please. Excuse me, we'll just get... try and get a microphone to you. I should have warned people I was going to do this. I never do that. Here we go. Microphone is on its way.
In your work, my name is Aaron Miskimmon, and in the work that you do of conflict resolution and peace building, how much do you include women? Mm-hmm. Because there is an issue, as you know, here in Northern Ireland and in the whole application of UN Security Council Resolution 1325, which we're working upon here in Northern Ireland and hopefully get more women involved. Would you make that an object of the peace and work that you do?
I don't necessarily make it an object, but I think it is extremely important. And I do remember when we used to negotiate with the Shinners, they would always turn up for the TV cameras with three men and two women, and then as soon as we started negotiating, the cameras left, the two women would leave the room and would be left with three men. So sometimes it's a little bit symbolic. What I would like to see actually is really involving women in that process. And indeed, all of our funders, the Norwegian government and people like that, require that, and it's important to do. If you make it an object, you could, for example, we're negotiating with armed groups, Islamic armed groups, to insist that they bring women could be... could make it harder to make the negotiations work. And one of the rules I have is I never turn up with a third agenda. I don't come along to impose things on the negotiators. I'm trying to bring the two parties together and not to raise new hurdles to success, but to actually try and help them reach an agreement. So I don't want to impose things on them from outside. Nonetheless, it is my experience around the world, they're unlikely to succeed unless they are going to have an accountable system when they finish, unless they're going to respect human rights, unless they give proper roles to women. we work in Syria, for example, with the Syrian opposition, and one of the interesting things of the vision document they launched last week was that they had a quota system that at least a third of all representatives in the assembly and so on should be women. So it does get through eventually, but there's an awfully long way to go.
Any other points on conflict resolution or... Sorry, also in the front row here.
I just feel very strongly that the conflict resolution doesn't go far enough. I mean, we've got an awful problem with victims.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you go to meetings and you think you're going to move forward. And, I mean, very sad as it is, we need to move forward and kind of leave, unfortunately, leave a lot of the victims behind to deal with their own problems, hopefully with help, but it has to be a big part of the conflict revolution that they get that help.
Yeah.
Obviously, resolving the past has been a big gap in our recent agreements.
It has been. One of the things we didn't manage to do in Northern Ireland was finding a way to deal with the past. And when we left government, we set up the Eames-Bradley Commission, and that failed to come up with acceptable solution for both sides for putting the past behind them. And the danger is that Northern Ireland is constantly dragged back into the past by the rest of Gerry Adams, the OTRs, or whatever it might be. This is not a problem that's unique to Northern Ireland. It's a problem that we have in pretty much every conflict that we deal with. In Colombia, interestingly, they had the issue because now with the ICC, you can't have just amnesty for the crimes. You can't even do what we did in Northern Ireland of letting people out after 2 years. That would not be acceptable under ICC rules. So in Colombia, it's the first time there's been an agreement where they had to have a system of transitional justice. That meant that the people who are signing the agreement have to pay some sort of recompense. Now, if you sit down with a group like the FARC and tell them that we want you to sign a peace agreement, but by the way, you, the person signing the agreement, are going to jail for 30 years, for some reason they don't seem inclined to actually sign the agreement. So we have to get a balance between the justice, because we can't leave the victims unaddressed, but they have to think also about the victims of the future. If you don't have an agreement, there are going to be more victims in the future. So you have to pay respect to the victims of the past, you have to try and get to an agreement and combine peace and justice, and you have to try and put a line behind you that allows you to move on and not constantly be dwelling on the past. So I agree with you. Quite often, though, victims, interestingly, are amongst those most supportive of a peace process. I remember Colin Parry saying to me, the father of Tim Parry in Warrington, the 12-year-old who was blown up, he said if anyone had told him that the British government was talking to the IRA when his son died in his arms, he would have been horrified. If anyone had told him 6 months later, after Tim's death, that the British government was talking to the IRA, he'd have been delighted because he knew that the peace process was going to come to the end. The same is true of the victims in Colombia. They want to have their rights addressed. They've actually been invited to the negotiation and come to the table. But now there is a peace process. They're amongst the most vocal advocates of the peace agreement being endorsed in the referendum and moving on to the future of Colombia rather than constantly dwelling on the past.
Can you, Jonathan, can you recall a moment when, obviously, you would have been privy to what was coming down a long time before me or the general public, when you knew, for instance, about the prisoner releases or you knew about the OTR pardons?
Yep.
Were you thinking there, what's the reception going to be like when this makes its way into the public domain?
Well, certainly on the prisons issue we were, because it came, actually, it was quite a shock. I mean, I totally stupid, but we hadn't been focusing on the prisoner issue in the Good Friday negotiations until the very last couple of days. And as I say in my book, Great Hatred, Little Room, actually, Adams persuaded us to agree prisoners should be released, if necessary, after only 1 year instead of after 2 years. But we then backed off that and went back to 2 years. And you remember the release of the Balcombe Street gang led to, and the pictures of them at the Sinn Féin Congress, led to a real problem in the referendum here in Northern Ireland, when the pictures of them punching the air in victory really set people back on the peace process. So you do face these kind of problems. In terms of the OTRs, the thing about the controversy last year, if it was last year, it struck me as completely bizarre, is that the OTR issue itself was very public. And the problem we had was we were never able to fulfill our promise on the OTRs. We knew that we were going to have controversy over finding a way of dealing with them. But we tried to deal with them in overt and public ways like legislation. And the list, which was dealing with people who by definition were not wanted, always struck me as a bizarre thing to have a controversy about.
Okay, well, let's watch.
I mean, surely within conflict resolution, there must be some way of separating the victims and making another line within the conflict resolution where you're moving forward,
yeah.
But somehow or another, the victims are being dealt with. And then that leads me on to the next questions. how are you funded, and where does the funding come for both those lines of inquiry?
I would actually rather take the opposite point of view in terms of separating victims out. I think what was so good in Colombia was they involved the victims. The victims came to the negotiation. They were able to express their views, what had happened to them. I thought that was really powerful thing that they did. So I wouldn't want to separate the victims from the conflict.
Stop a conversation.
Well,
I mean, if somebody has really suffered,
and
out of respect of the fact that they have suffered, all other conversation stops.
Well, the impact in Colombia was not that. When they came to the table, talked about their suffering and said that they wanted to have peace, it was one of the moments that galvanized the process towards succeeding. So I'm not sure I agree with you on that. I think that victims do have to be dealt with if you're going to... And they have to be dealt with, if nothing else, because of the ICC requirements now, the International Criminal Court. You cannot have an agreement where there is amnesty, because otherwise the ICC will come and prosecute people instead of the national government. So it's not possible to do. In terms of funding, we will not be funded by anyone involved in the conflict. We get money from neutral governments like Norway, Sweden, Canada, and places like that.
Okay. I was going to suggest that maybe we play clip one, because we may take a little bit of a segue back into Jonathan's earlier time in Downing Street. And I think this is a clip where you're talking to the BBC about rivalries between Downing Street and the Foreign Office.
I thought it was Treasury.
Ironically, Jonathan Powell was recruited by another destiny prime minister and was the Powell behind the throne throughout Tony Blair's years in number 10.
Like most prime ministers, when Tony Blair came to office, as when Thatcher came to office, they were basically interested in domestic policy rather than foreign policy. So when they get into the job and they realise what they've got to do in terms of foreign policy, how much of the responsibility lies on them, that's when they get fascinated by it.
And were you aware of how the Foreign Office saw Tony Blair in terms of what was said to be a marginalising of the Foreign Office because he would take over foreign policy himself?
Well, yes, of course. I came from the Foreign Office, so I knew precisely what they thought when my brother was there, and they felt that Thatcher had been marginalising the Foreign Office on foreign policy. And then I knew what they thought when we were there, and they thought the same thing. There's always a sense in the Foreign Office that number 10 is trying to trump them, trying to run foreign policy, and it should really be left to them. But for the Prime Minister, it is somehow easier to make things happen in foreign policy. You can, by saying something or doing something, change things in a way that takes a much longer time in domestic policy. If you're changing health or education, there's a long, hard grind to make things change. Foreign policy, by attending a conference, agreeing a EU budget, or whatever it is, you can make a bold stroke much more easily.
That's about the relations between Downing Street and the Foreign Office, but it takes us back to that time, of course, when you were physically sat outside Tony Blair's door as the actual gatekeeper. There was no kind of sort of symbolic gatekeeper involved in this. That's the way that you made sure you had his ear and that anybody who wanted to get to him had to go through you.
Well, there were five people in the outer office, so I wasn't physically stopping people going in. There was someone else to do that. But it is actually... someone had told me in the White House before I went back to do this job that access is power. Proximity is power. And it is true. If you sit near the person in power, you are more likely to be called on by him, and he's likely... So I tried moving further away at different stages, but it never worked because Tony wanted to come out, ask me something, go back into a meeting and make a decision. So it was always crucial to be close, however uncomfortable. I noticed the new Prime Minister has two chiefs of staff, so my job's been multiplied twice.
And is that a recipe for disaster?
I don't know. Maybe, actually, Trudeau in Canada has two chiefs of staff too, also a man and a woman sharing the job. I'm just curious how they divide the job up between them.
And obviously, the geography of power is quite important, because there you've got a sense that there are people in the Foreign Office saying, look, you in Downing Street are taking all the power and the influence away from us. Tony Blair is wanting to do all the foreign policy himself. Yet in your book, The New Machiavelli, you write, where's the quote, that the main thing a Prime Minister notices on entering Downing Street for the first time is how illusory power really is. So in Downing Street, at the centre of the web, you were feeling like you didn't have the influence that everybody else ascribed to you.
Yeah, you do. When you come into power, you think it's going to be like the end of the rainbow and there's going to be a crock of gold and it's all going to be easy. In fact, you discover that in No. 10 Downing Street, you have no civil servants to speak of. You don't have great departments, as the Secretary of State do. You have no budget to speak of. You don't have some huge budget you can spend. And your only tool, actually, is either to hire people, appoint them as ministers, or sack them, or to persuade them to do things. And the real secret of the British system is actually that power is not centralized in the center. The only power in the center is the power to cajole, persuade, and move people forward. Now, some prime ministers are stronger than others because they have a political mandate that's stronger than others. Tony Blair was elected with a landslide. And when you have that kind of result, you obviously have more influence on your colleagues. And the other thing that happens is over time, prime ministers tend to become more expert than their colleagues. Their colleagues have been there for 2 or 3 years. A prime minister may have been like Thatcher for 11, 12 years, or like Tony Blair for 10 years. They know the subjects, they know the procedures, and therefore they can do things more easily by themselves, and they can out-trump their colleagues if they choose to do so.
Now, at the start of this conversation, you acknowledged that defending Tony Blair's reputation is proving almost as hard a task as defending Machiavelli's. In the wake of the Chilcot report, have you been given room for doubt?
Well, I can't pretend the Chilcot inquiry was a great success for the Blair government. I think that actually if you read the report itself rather than the necessarily Chilcot statement, you get a slightly different take on his judgments, because what he put in his statement was not what's in the report. I think you'd be hard-pressed to say the invasion of Iraq had turned out to be a great success and what people wanted it to be. On the other hand, I have to say, looking at Syria, that non-intervention in Syria has scarcely turned out to be a great success. Twice as many people have died, many more, the biggest humanitarian disaster in the world today. And it has consequences for us. We can intervene and screw up like Iraq, or we can not intervene and screw up like Syria, and we end up with a problem of immigration, and we end up with a problem of ISIS acting here in Europe. And it won't be long before there is attack in London of the sort we've seen in Paris and Brussels, as the security chiefs keep saying. So we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. In fact, the next book I'm trying to write is exactly about this subject, about interventionism, about liberal interventionism. Why do we get it wrong one way and why do we get it wrong the other way? Why do we have a Rwanda? Why do we have a Bosnia where we don't do anything? And then why do we have an Iraq or an Afghanistan? There has to be some lesson we can draw from these. I felt the Chilcot inquiry didn't actually give us any general lessons. I've been working as a special envoy in Libya for the last nearly 3 years now. And when I went to Libya, the thing that they said to me, everyone said to me from all sides, was, thank you for supporting us in the revolution, but why on earth did you go away and desert us after the revolution and leave us to our own devices? We had no institutions. We had no way of building institutions. And I think, as President Obama said last year, the biggest mistake he said he'd made in foreign policy was exactly that, not following up on the invasion on the military action in Libya to help them build institutions. Now, there are reasons. The Prime Minister at the time, Mahmoud Jibril, was trying to urge Western powers to leave and so on. But I think the real thing that happened was that people tried to learn a lesson from Iraq. They said, Bremer in Iraq was the viceroy who was trying to rule. That was a terrible mistake. Let's not do that again. Actually, doing the opposite turned out to be an even worse mistake, because there was no way of helping the Libyans build institutions and deal with militias, and now we see the consequences of that. So non-intervention can be a disaster like Syria, intervention like Iraq can go wrong, and partial intervention just from the air like Libya can go wrong. And there has to be, we're going to have to do better than that, because just leaving things alone and running away home doesn't work. And we're going to have to work out how to do it properly.
Just on Libya, since you mentioned it, David Cameron appointed you as a special envoy. Has Theresa May kept you on in that role?
No, I stood down with the change of Prime Minister. I wasn't making a difference.
Here, just in recent weeks, we've seen local politicians once again pressing on the whole issue of compensation. They believe that Tony Blair, when he was in government, should have done more on that, given the supplies of Semtex from Colonel Gaddafi to the IRA. Do you see the rightness of that cause in terms of compensation for victims, and do you think that it'll get anywhere or not?
Well, I was explicitly excluded from dealing with that issue when I was appointed to the job. Obviously, I'd like there to be compensation. If you look at the situation in Libya, that's not top of their list of priorities at the moment in Libya, because there is no government with a budget that could do any of this. So we're going to wait till we actually get to a coherent government before that can be addressed sensibly.
You were referring there to the Iraq war. Obviously, that was the sort of big full stop at the end of Tony Blair's career, which he will always be remembered. In a sense, was it that liberal interventions up until then had sort of gone to some extent according to plan, the Sierra Leones, the Kosovos, and you were used to working so closely in alliance with the United States that maybe when the new president came in, you didn't put the kind of distance you should have put in between Downing Street and the White House. So I think there was a famous quote you were meant to have said to Sir Christopher Mayer, the UK ambassador to the US, that you wanted him to get up the arse of the White House and stay there. Should he have got out of it?
Well, given my views of Christopher Mayer, I'd be quite pleased if he'd stayed up. But there's not my quote, it was his quote, what he said. I never said that to him.
Right.
I think actually one of the disasters, we now have two disasters in our foreign policy. One of the disasters was to let the transatlantic relationship become so etiolated as it has become. The way that Britain has managed to influence its future in the world is twofold since the Second World War, essentially, either through Europe, or rather both through Europe and through the transatlantic relationship. First, the Tory government allowed the transatlantic relationship to become very, very weak. They reduced the armed forces to the extent that we can offer very little assistance to the United States now. And they deliberately distanced themselves from the United States by, for example, siding with China on a series of issues, including the Asian Bank. So that the French actually look like more reliable allies than Britain does now to the United States. I think that is a major problem for our foreign policy going forward. Brexit and leaving the EU has now taken away the second pillar of our foreign policy and means that we no longer have any influence in that way. When I was working on Libya, most of the things we did were through the EU. Now we no longer are going to have the ability to coordinate in that way. It's very hard to see what our foreign policy is going to look like in the future with both those pillars kicked away.
I know you were talking about Brexit yesterday, so I don't want to go too much over that ground because I know some of the people who were in the audience there yesterday may well be here again today. But in your book, you talked about the effort that you put in to ensure that Britain was at the heart of Europe to try to insert yourselves into that German-French axis. And yet you've seen that all completely unpicked over time now.
Well, if you're going to be in the EU, the only sensible course is to try and have a leading role in the EU. And what we tried desperately to do was to try and get a role with the French and the Germans to try and invite ourselves into that relationship. And so we found it very, very difficult to do. Eventually, we finally, after 9/11, we managed to get a meeting in Bruges, I think it was, with Chirac and Schroeder and us. And it was a real cacophony because we had translators, everyone was talking at once with German, French, and English translators all going at the same time. But we actually got a joint meeting with the three, and finally we were at the center of decision-making in Europe. We then tried to follow it up by having a meeting in Downing Street. So we announced a meeting in Downing Street with Chirac and Schroeder. And immediately Berlusconi was on the phone in tears saying that if we didn't come, it's going to be the end for Italy. So we invited Berlusconi. Immediately we got a call from Aznar saying he had to come. He was not having an argument about it. He was just coming because he could not be left out as the leader of Spain. Then we had a call from the president of the commission at the time of the president, it was there, Verhofstadt anyway, the president of the, it was Barroso, the president of the commission, who insisted that he had to come too. And finally, as we're sitting down to dinner, Wim Kok of the Netherlands called up and said he had to come as well. But by the time he got there, we had no food left. He had to have the vegetarian option. But it completely undermined our attempt to get to a tripartite ruling of Europe. But we did succeed in influencing what happened in Europe. What we failed to do was change British attitudes on Europe, and I think that was a failure. But we did change our position within Europe. Once the Tories came in, Cameron had no choice of doing that because he was constrained by his backbenchers. He had to be on the margins of Europe. And one of the reasons he lost the referendum is he made Europe look like something that happened to us rather than it seems to the French and Germans something that they drive. And that's the fundamental flaw in European policy.
Of course, the European Union isn't the only arena in which there was a clash of egos that you had to deal with. A lot of your book is devoted to the Blair-Brown relationship or lack of relationship at times. Was it true that during most of the time in power, Gordon Brown simply wouldn't speak to you?
Well, only for 12 years. When I first arrived in Tony's office, there was an opposition from the civil service. There was no money, and I went off and raised some money from Paul Hamlin, a great man. And when I got it, I got a call from Gordon Brown, who asked me to come round to his office. And I went round to his office, and he made me sit down in front of his desk and said, there's an agreement I would share all the money we raised with him, and I burst into laughter. And he didn't take that very well, and so he didn't speak to me till we were just about to leave government, when he very nicely said to me, congratulations on Northern Ireland, which was very nice of him.
Obviously, we talked about things in terms of the European Union not working out as you would have wished. Things in terms of the Labour Party have not exactly worked out as you wished. What are your reflections on the state of the party today under Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, it's clearly a disaster. It clearly looks like Jeremy Corbyn will win the leadership election. The PLP will then, the Parliamentary Labour Party will then face a choice of what they do. Do they simply say, OK, we're going to stay with Jeremy Corbyn? But I think there's a problem in that there is now, if you like, a gap in the political market. There is no one representing a pro-European, socially liberal, fiscally tight type of political party. It seems to me there's a large part of the electorate that is at the moment unrepresented. And it's a particular problem when we are engaged in the Brexit negotiations. No one is actually challenging the government when they say Brexit means Brexit. What on earth do they mean? I think that is a real gap in our democratic system if you don't have a party like that. Now, normally, nature abhors a vacuum, and that gap will be filled in some way. There will be a pro-European party that springs up. At the moment, the Lib Dems seem incapable of filling that gap. The Greens don't have the power to fill it. So, but from somewhere, whether it's the Labour Party changing or a new party, there will be a party that fills that role.
A sort of new Social Democrats, perhaps.
Well, the trouble with the Social Democrats, as they showed, was the problem of the first-past-the-post system, that if you come in and you can't get that, you will disappear very quickly. But it may be we're seeing some changes in political parties around the world. After Trump, the Republican Party is going to have to reconfigure itself. You know, the Republican Party changed fundamentally with Nixon when the old country club Republicans accepted the Southern Democrats in as their key ally. With Reagan, it changed too, building a coalition between blue-collar workers and the middle class. Thatcher built a coalition here between the lower middle class and the upper middle class. Tony Blair built it between Mondio Man and the working class. Those sort of coalitions change, and I suspect we're in a moment where coalitions are about to change again, and you're going to see a reconfiguration of political parties both in the United Kingdom and in the United States, but I can't predict quite how they will be configured at the end.
This seems like a suitable time to see if anybody else has got any questions on these other themes that we've been talking about, not just conflict resolution, but either the broad scope of politics or indeed Labour Party, anyone wanting to get a point in?
It's
yes, back. We'll just wait for the microphone to get you.
Hello, Jonathan. You were over in Northern Ireland last year to launch the Loyalist Communities Council, and part of what you said was that the reason for the difficulties that we experience still with certain groups within Loyalism is that they have felt disaffected and marginalised and left behind. Why do you think that is?
I think it's partly because they don't have a political voice. They don't feel that since the death of David Irvine, they're actually represented. That's part of the problem. I think partly they are stuck in a sort of victim's mentality. They feel that the Shinners have managed to get all the good things out of the agreement, and they haven't. There isn't actually that much evidence for that, but that's what they believe. And partly I think it's they're stuck in the absence of any real role models of people who are succeeding, who could drag them out of the position they find themselves in. And it did seem to me that the policy of the last 10 years with loyalists, which is to leave it as a policing issue, hasn't succeeded. They haven't dealt with the criminality, they haven't dealt with the drugs, they haven't dealt with the prostitution. And it's worth, it seems to me, trying a new approach where you have some positive effort to pull the loyalists out of that. Those who want to go straight and make a success of things should be given some encouragement, coupled with a pretty tough approach to those who want to stay in criminality, stay drug dealing and all the rest of it. And I guess particularly if this fresh start approach is going to come to something real in the next few months, that seems to me a real opportunity to do that, to offer those who want to bring their communities forward to try and deal with this problem of education, and in particular, and that then deal with those who stay dealing with crime in the traditional way. But it seems just carrying on with the same policy isn't going to get us any different result than what we've had so far.
Any other points from the floor? I think, yes, there's a point at the back here. There's a lady here.
Oh, me? Oh.
Yeah.
The word dictator was mentioned in the introduction. We haven't heard anything about dictators since. And I was interested to see two news items about dictators. One was Mr. Putin, and they were having elections in very rural part of Russia. And there was a grizzled old lady crying her eyes out with joy because Mr. Putin had increased her pension. And then there was another dictator mentioned. Now, I can't remember whether it's North Korea or South Korea, that this Kim person. Where is he? North Korea.
North Korea.
Yeah.
Kim Jong-un.
There was news of him having executed a colleague of his simply because the colleague slumped in his chair. And he doesn't seem to care what image he's giving out. Mr. Putin must do to a certain extent because he appealed to the old lady by giving her pensions. Have you ever thought about the psychology of dictators?
Let that be a warning to any of you considering slumping in your chairs. The psychology of dictators.
The interesting thing about dictators is they care enormously about their images, even more than democratic politicians. Kim Jong-un, I mean, look at his haircut. He's trying to look exactly like his grandfather, because his grandfather, he feels, is popular. So he has that. If you go to... I've worked in Pyongyang a bit in the last few years, and if you go to the new museum they've built of the what they call the Great Patriotic War, the war against South Korea and the Americans, there's a huge statue that at first you would mistake for Kim Jong-un, but actually it's supposed to be a statue of his grandfather Kim Il-sung. So he goes to great lengths to look exactly like his grandfather. Every picture of him is terribly carefully manicured. If you go to the mausoleum of his father and grandfather, where they're embalmed bodies lie. It's a really very bizarre experience. You go on a walkway, which you're not allowed to walk on. It's a moving walkway like in an airport, but you mustn't walk because that would be disrespectful. And there are literally hundreds of pictures of the father, grandfather, and the young man, all in various poses, pointing and so on. And then eventually you have to go into the where the body is. And to do that, you go through a sort of arch of reverse vacuum cleaners that are blowing dust off you, so you don't have any dust when you get in there with the body. And when you get to the body, you have to bow at the feet, side, the head, and the other side. So image for someone like Kim Jong-un is absolutely everything, and they devote themselves to, their whole department's devoted to image. Putin is similar from that point of view. Even before Putin was first elected, we decided to try and reach out to him. And so Tony Blair went to visit him in St. Petersburg during the election campaign. And I remember they took us to a wonderful opera in St. Petersburg where Napoleon was defeated and driven out of Russia, and the French flag was stamped underfoot, and we all celebrated the defeat of the French. And he seemed like a new leader after Yeltsin. You know, Yeltsin had been a very strange guy. I remember when Tony first met him, we met him in a summit in Paris. And Putin came up to him and gave him this huge, great bear hug, which seemed like a very nice gesture to start with. And then after 10 seconds, it seemed like a slightly odd but very nice gesture. After 30 seconds, Tony was in serious fear that he was going to be crushed to death. And only after a minute was he released. So the replacement of Yeltsin by Putin was actually a sort of breath of fresh air. But then I watched as Putin became more and more hubristic as he remained in power. He became more and more obsessed with his image, the bare-chested shots, the pictures of him killing tigers with his bare hands and all the rest of it. And so for a dictator, image is literally everything. But image in the whole doesn't save them in the end. They will get brought down in the way that all past dictators have been.
Who was the scariest person that you came face to face with?
Oh, gosh.
Did you meet Gaddafi or not? Or was that all Tony Blair?
I met Gaddafi. The Gaddafi meeting was an amusing one rather than a scary one. He was basically like sort of member of the Rolling Stones, so slightly out of it, elderly and very sort of... But we turned up in the desert to meet him in the desert, and he had all these tents, and they had nice hangings on them, and there were lots of white camels milling around. And Tony, trying to make conversation, said, "Do you always have these white camels here?" And Gaddafi said, "No, I don't know why they're here. Apparently your PR people asked for them." he then gave us a lecture about the Jamhira, which is the system of government he used. And he had his chief of staff bring in this big chart of the Jamhira that's sort of circular and ran around and put on an easel. And he started talking, and about after 10 minutes he said, no, this is quite the wrong way round. And he had his chief of staff come and put the chart the other way up. And we still found the system of government completely incomprehensible. He wasn't scary, he was just very odd.
Whilst there were obviously photo opportunities with Colonel Gaddafi, in your book I think you talk about avoiding photo opportunities with Robert Mugabe.
Well, trying to avoid photo opportunities from Mugabe. One of the problems, I don't quite understand the alphabet, but for some reason Zimbabwe is sit next to United Kingdom at official functions. So at the death of one of the popes, Tony turned up in his seat to find himself next to Mugabe and immediately fled to the back of the auditorium, only to have the Vatican officials keep trying to propel him back to the front seat where he should have been sitting, which he refused to do. And you remember Jack Straw ran into his slight difficulty at the UN when he shook hands with Mugabe, as he put it, by mistake, because he didn't recognise who he was.
Any other points from the floor? Yes, in the second row here. Sorry, we'll just get a microphone to you. I don't think anyone's going anywhere anyway, no, because it sounds like there's a deluge outside.
Would you say, in spite of dictators being odd and often very cruel, that they are better than a power vacuum that seems to be what's left if you remove people like Gaddafi and the other Middle Eastern dictators, because then you just get anarchism and you get religious extremism stepping in?
No, I wouldn't. I think that actually, however awful a transition looks, if you don't go through that transition, you will never escape from the dictator. And if you speak to the people themselves who are living through this, for example, talk to the Syrians with whom we work, they would, however horrible what they're going through is, they wouldn't want Assad to stay in place, nor would most of the Iraqis, even the Sunnis in the north, want Saddam back again. You sometimes have to go through these awful transitions to escape from those sort of dictators. If you think about Latin America 25, 30 years ago, it was riddled with dictators, it was riddled with corrupt regimes, it was riddled with civil wars in which people were dying. And now, 25 years later, it looks like a big success story. This civil war ending in Colombia, in which 250,000 people died, went on for more than 50 years, is the last civil war in Latin America. There are still some pretty dodgy governments like Venezuela, but even in Argentina, the system has been turned over by the election of a moderate and sensible leader. So there is a very painful transition to go through, but by wishing on people dictators, I think we're making things much worse for them. I remember when I joined the Foreign Office, people saying to me, we should hang on to Brezhnev, he's the best Brezhnev we've got. Actually, he wasn't. Even though we don't like Putin, you wanted to escape that old Soviet system, and the only way to do it was to have those leaders replaced.
But if one goes back to the Arab Spring, wasn't there a great naivety on the part of many who thought that somehow democracy would flourish and instead we got anarchy?
I think we've misunderstood, we got the Arab Spring wrong both ways round. We didn't start the Arab Spring, they started it. If we thought it was suddenly going to be easy and everything would be milk and honey afterwards, that was a mistake. But if we think it's over now and you're going to have the continuation of the dictators we see in place today, that's also a mistake. The Arab Spring is not over. It's less than halfway through. And we know from our history what happens. If you have a revolution, you'll have a counter-revolution. If you have a revolution, you'll have a Napoleon figure, a dictator will take over. But you do, in the end, get change. And we have a very short-term view to these issues. We look at them in sort of 1 or 2 year snatches at most. We don't take a 10, a 20-year view. And that's what you need to do if you're working in foreign policy of that sort.
Now, a number of hands up. Sorry, lady just at the back there, sorry. Just it's about 3 or 4 rows back, sorry. And then I'll come to you. So.
Could we define what we mean by dictators? Because you've mentioned Putin has been a dictator. I think that's questionable. But you've also mentioned all the dictatorships in South America that we supported. And we still support despotic monarchies throughout the Middle East.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would accuse British or indeed most other foreign policies of being consistent. Certainly haven't been historically. I think it was a mistake to support many of those dictators. To call Putin a dictator, he certainly is elected, but then so is Kim Jong-un elected. The question is how viable those or how honest those elections are, the elections that are happening today in Russia, whether those are really genuinely fair elections, which might be a questionable proposition. But I do think we do need to be more consistent than we've been. But to think that you can have a purely consistent foreign policy and not deal, for example, with Sisi in Egypt is very difficult. You may not like Sisi, but he is in power in Egypt. And you're going to, the prospect of having no relations with him probably isn't going to make the lot of Egyptian people any better. But equally, supporting dictators and trying to keep them in place against uprisings strikes me as being proved pretty safely in Latin America and elsewhere is a mistaken policy as well. So more consistency, but unlikely to get to full consistency is what I would say.
I think there was a gentleman at the front was looking to get in.
Mr. Paul, I'm really enjoying listening to you speak. I would like to speak about mental health and mental resilience among the world leaders that some you've had proximity to. If we accept that perhaps leaders have made decisions that have led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and led to parts of the world turning into absolute anarchy, Iraq, and I wouldn't divorce what we did in Iraq from what's happening now in Syria, among other places. But in your opinion, how does someone who inadvertently made decisions that perhaps allegedly led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, how does a world leader like George W. Bush or a Tony Blair cope with that mentally, psychologically?
Well, people obviously deal with it in different ways, and I doubt that George W. Bush and Tony Blair would have dealt with it in the same way. But one thing that really struck me being in government and sort of close to leaders is when a leader gets into a war, they don't do it sort of very easily. When we first went into Iraq, when we first started bombing Iraq with Bill Clinton, and later when we went into Kosovo, I remember Tony Blair agonizing about it and finding it a very, very lonely decision. I remember he asked me to get Mrs. Thatcher to come in and see him, and I brought her into number 10 Downing Street, and they sat by themselves talking for an hour or so about making a decision like that. I remember because she then came out and complained to me about the state of the upholstery on the chairs in the in the drawing room, which she had a point. But leaders do find it very difficult to make those decisions. And I remember when right at the beginning of Iraq, when that first helicopter was shot down and the Marines, it crashed and the Marines died. I remember in the middle of the night we got the call and Tony Blair was very, very, very upset about it. And when you're putting people's lives at risk, your own soldiers and the lives of other people, of course, you dwell on it. It's not something you can forget at all easily. So you're right, it's something that people can never escape for the rest of their lives. But equally, people don't, on the whole, in democracies anyway, make those decisions for cynical reasons. They don't, as the Chilcot report points out, don't make up the reasons for doing it. They're reasons that they genuinely believe, and they believe they're making the decision because it's the right thing to do. And although I've devoted the rest of my life to working on conflict resolution, I do actually think there still is a place for military force, and military force does have to be deployed in certain places. And the way it was deployed in Kosovo that led to the end of Milosevic, I think, was clearly the right thing to do. Likewise in Sierra Leone. And places like Afghanistan and Iraq, the question is much cloudier. But you're right, it is a very difficult burden for leaders. And one of the reasons I personally think leaders, there are sort of effectively a term limit for leaders, that if you stay more than 10 years in a democracy, you're probably making a mistake. Mrs. Thatcher, had she left after 10 years, her reputation would be much better than it is today after she was thrown out. Bertie Ahern in the Republic, had he left after 10 years instead of waiting to be forced out the door. So Tony Blair did leave after 10 years. His reputation still has a problems because of Iraq. But I think Angela Merkel ought to think quite carefully about, she's done just over 10 years now. Does she really want to wait there till someone throws her out, or should she leave now? But you're right about the mental pressures on leaders.
Thank you very much. Now, unless anyone has an absolutely burning point, I noticed from looking at my watch that our allocated hour is up. And I don't know about you, but for me, it felt like it went past in about 5 minutes. And for that, I think we owe a round of applause to Jonathan Powell. Thank you very much.